Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Galbraith, Chair in the Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project, and his books include The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, and Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do American CEOs Get Paid So Much? Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And you're certainly welcome to comment on the extraordinary day of news today before we get into the subject of your article, if you're up to it or interested.
No, go ahead.
Well, why then? You've asked the question, why do America CEOs get paid so much? Why?
Well, this is a study that was done by economists at the Economic Policy Institute on which The Guardian asked me to make a comment. So I'm basically giving their report and making some observations on it. And what they found was that about 80% of the pay of the pay package of the top American corporate executives is closely tied to the stock market, which is no great surprise. It comes out of stock options realized and unrealized, and that's where the big money really is, which has a number of interesting implications. It means, among other things, that what has happened to American corporations is in part due to the fact that their chief executives have such a very strong incentive to boom the stock price. That's not necessarily the same thing as keeping the corporations going over the long term as strong and competitive going concerns.
Well, we know that there's a lot of buyback of stock, et cetera.
Buybacks, of course, are a corporate strategy, but one has to remember that the buybacks are enabled and facilitated by government policies, including, for example, the quantitative easing policy of the Federal Reserve, which made a lot of cheap money available to corporations, which they could then use to buy back their stock, and the Trump tax cuts, which cut taxes for businesses, giving them a lot of additional retained earnings, which, again, they could use to buy back their stock. And that's what they did, by and large. There's been some improvement in the business investment picture, but a very large amount was almost immediately announced by major companies that they were going to use to raise their stock price. And of course, when you have a CEO who has a strong incentive to do that, it makes a very generous gift to himself or herself in a few cases.
So can you make the case that this excessive CEO pay is bad for American capitalism in as much as too much money is being diverted into the corporate suites and not enough into R&D and the shop floor?
Yeah, I think you can make that case. I mean, you can make it going back a very long period of time. The industrial corporations of the time when American industry dominated the world financed most of their investment out of retained earnings, and they were intent upon maintaining their global market share, their national market share. And you have models of those American corporations that continue to function, in particular in Japan, in Korea, and in Germany. Those countries have corporations which continue to function by and large on those terms, and their chief executives are paid mostly in salary and mostly are committed to their companies over a much longer term than the American ones are. So this shift of the American corporation really since the 1980s into having the CEO basically strongly incentivized to boost the stock price has had a very bad effect on the viability of the companies that they run.
Well, I've always wondered why it is that American CEOs who move around like NFL football coaches, why it is they have extraordinary skills that somehow they can move from a company that makes nuclear submarines to one that makes bicycles and cans pineapple.
Well, the fact is, of course, that the companies are oriented to a very large degree to their financial management, and those abilities, if you want to call them that, are not specific to the industrial processes that are involved. But what it means is that the people who know how to make the can openers and the bottle tops and so forth are in a very subsidiary position inside these firms. They'll never reach the very top. They will be staying in those firms for as long as the firms are viable. And the corporate executives basically are finance people. And that's emblematic of what's happened to the American economy, the structure of the American economy as a whole.
And again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, Chair in Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project, and his books include The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, and Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do American CEOs Get Paid So Much? So when you consider the difference between the 312-1 ratio here in the United States in terms of income inequality between CEOs and the median workers. In, of course, the UK, it's 94-1, and in Sweden, it's 40-1. Japan also, I believe, Germany and Japan, the figures aren't hard to get. There's a lot of, particularly in Germany, right, there's a lot of private corporations that.
That's correct. I'm a little bit wary of this very fashionable comparison of the pay of 350 people compared to the broad population, and that 312 is to the median worker in the industry, not necessarily in the specific firm. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking at is a comparison of what is basically stock market appreciation to payout of corporate cash flow. And that's kind of an apples and oranges comparison. But it is again, telling us about how the firms are run. It's also a very volatile number, actually. It was higher in 2000. Over the last 2 years, according to the study, it was flat, and then it rose 17% in 2017. To say, okay, why was that? Well, the stock market went up, and I think it's also likely the case that these corporate executives sensed that the market was going to peak out, which it has done, and decided to cash in, which then boosted their earnings in 2017. So there's all of that. It's kind of a manipulation, but let's not kid ourselves. There's 350 people. Making, in some cases, $20 million a year. That's a lot, but they're probably quite a lot of people, private equity, hedge funds, who make considerably more than that in the United States. And if you're talking about the really ultra wealthy, if you're talking about the oligarchs who've come in from Russia or for that matter, are still there, princes in Saudi Arabia, then these numbers are, they're not the first thing you would look at.
Right. Mohammed bin Salman could even put Jeff Bezos to shame, I think, and Bezos apparently is worth $157 billion.
If you take a look at the scale of his palaces, that's I think, a fair observation.
Right. But let's talk about some statistics that I think are pretty indisputable, and that is that the richest 5% of Americans have captured 74% of the wealth created in this country from 1983 to 2010. That's a report from the Economic Policy Institute. And the richest 400 Americans control more wealth than the poorest 80 million of U.S. households. And the top 1% now hold 40% of the nation's wealth. Do you have any quibbles with those statistics?
I do have some quibbles with them. I think people who know my politics know a very strong progressive. But I think it's important to be aware that when those numbers are cited, the references to financial wealth, of which many millions of American households have practically none at all. So even the person who has $100 or $200 or $1,000 has more than a great many who have zero. So it's a comparison that one has to be wary of, and one has to be aware that there are social insurance programs of great importance in this country, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, deposit insurance, nutrition assistance, so you can go down the list, housing support, which have been very strongly available to the middle class. They don't show up in those wealth figures, but they are the foundation of what makes a strong and successful middle class. What makes a strong, successful middle class is not a lot of people with small amounts in the stock market. It's people with secure retirements guaranteed by successful and stable government programs. And we have had that. They're constantly under attack. It's exceedingly important to remember that the progressive goal should be to sustain and support those systems so that we can continue to have a secure and comfortable and middle class, one which is able to support itself, but also able to look forward to, a reasonable retirement and to protection in the case of medical emergencies and other things of that kind. And that's where our energy should be, it seems to me. And those numbers that we're just talking about simply don't capture that dimension, which strikes me as the most important dimension of a policy of social solidarity and social stabilization.
Right, but apparently 60%, I hate to keep quoting statistics, but 60% of Americans are $400 emergency payment away from penury. I mean, we're talking about CEO pay, but workers' pay has been flat since the 70s. So, you know, there's a great deal of social anxiety that comes with that insecurity, surely.
There is a great deal of social anxiety. I'm not going to argue that point. I'm just going to make a general observation, and I could cite statistics back at you, the difference between the United States today and the United States, let's say, in 1929, is an entire panoply of publicly administered social insurance programs that did not exist back in the late 1920s, that were created in the New Deal and the Great Society. And those programs have made and continue to make an enormous difference to American households. So if you're asking me, how do I assure that those American households that you just cited who are short cash are kept out of penury, the answer to that is I want to be sure that they all have access to, first of all, to jobs, and secondly, if they're disabled or if they're older or if they're in medical need, that those needs are covered by decent public insurance programs. When you do that, then the question personal or private wealth is something which is certainly nice to have. I'm not going to argue it, but it is not fundamental to staying out of deep penury and distress. And that's the important point.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, James Galbraith, I'm curious to get your take on Senator Warren's new plan to radically change how corporations are governed in the U.S., limiting how the majority of profits flow to shareholders at the expense of labor.
I haven't read Senator Warren's plan, so I'm afraid I can't help you with that. But I do think that the question of how U.S. corporations, particularly the largest corporations, are governed is an important question. The question of how our banks are governed is an important question. And we've seen that the failure to effectively supervise our banking system is a major source of instability and disaster in our economy, and one which has not been, which was not fully repaired in the wake of the crisis. And the repairs that were made are now being dismantled. So it's extremely important to have these discussions about how the American corporate system is governed, to have an economist of my acquaintance and indeed who shared my last name called countervailing power, in which the unions and the consumers and the public interest is represented effectively in ensuring that what we have is an economic system that serves not only private purpose but also public purpose.
Well, just in the last minute, will we recover from this huge giveaway to the $1.5 trillion dollar giveaway that Donald Trump has given to the super rich in the name of helping the middle class. And then on top of that, the Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, wants to give him an extra $100 billion.
You can always recover from that sort of thing. It's a question of having the determination and the political will and the votes to do it. We've been in much worse situations before. It's just a question of getting organized and moving the country to an understanding of what needs to be done.
And there's an opportunity on November the 6th of this year, right?
I hope there will be. It depends upon whether the Democratic Party presents effective choices.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who's the chair of the Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, and he's the author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do America's CEOs Get Paid So Much? We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the senator from Maine, Susan Collins, is either naive or cynical when she accepted Kavanaugh's assurance that Roe v. Wade was settled law.